This is Rabbi Jeffrey Sachs, editor of Tradition, with another Tradition podcast. Visit traditiononline.org for all of the offerings in our journal, including the recent summer 2020 issue, and find Tradition Journal on Facebook to keep up to date with all of the digital-only content that we produce on a regular basis. Our listeners will surely remember that our fall 2019 issue featured a large symposium on Professor Chaim Soloveitchik's seminal essay, Rupture and Reconstruction, to mark the 25th anniversary of that very significant contribution to our journal. The central feature of Rupture and Reconstruction was its focus on trends in Ashkenazic Orthodoxy in the 20th century. Given Professor Soloveitchik's well-known areas of scholarly interest and the community he was describing in the essay, it could hardly have been otherwise. Our recent symposium on the 25th anniversary neglected to offer other perspectives on the issue from a less Ashkenormative angle. We were pleased to reach out to Rabbi Joseph Dweck to offer a corrective, to offer his own reflection. He is uniquely situated to do so. For the last 6 years, he has been serving as the senior rabbi of the Spanish and Portuguese Sephardi community of the United Kingdom and is based in London, although he's a native of Los Angeles. Welcome to Tradition, Rabbi Dweck.
It's an honor and pleasure. Thank you, Rabbi Sachs, for having me.
In your essay, which is titled A Sephardic Response to Rupture and Reconstruction, and appears, as I said, in our most recent issue and is available to subscribers in print or on our website, you describe your own first encounter with Rupture and Reconstruction. And it's so interesting how many of the authors in the symposium filtered their thoughts on the essay through the autobiographical, what it meant to you when you first read it, how it resonated and was in some ways dissonant with your own experiences. You say that it was at once familiar and also alien. Explain to us in what ways you saw yourself in it, you saw your community in the essay, and in what ways it completely was going in a different direction and didn't resonate with your own experiences.
Sure. Reading it, there was a very keen sense that I had, in that he was describing the Orthodox Jewish world that I knew, and essentially in which I grew up. You know, I did grow up in Los Angeles, born in 1975, and I lived in Los Angeles for 20 years until I got married. I was living in a Sephardic family, in a Sephardic community, very small one in Los Angeles, but we were, of course, neighbors and embedded in a broader Ashkenazic Orthodox community. And so, I was very familiar with that world, the people, the rabbis, the culture. And, reading Professor Soloveitchik's description was not at all foreign to me in that sense. In other words, I knew what it was that he was describing. Firsthand, I had seen it and recognized it. But it also brought to me a very keen awareness that I had growing up that my home, my synagogue, my Jewish practice was not like the parallel Ashkenazic practice and milieu, if you will, that was happening outside of my home and my congregation. And, I struggled as a kid to find a reflection of my Judaism, what I knew and how I was raised, anywhere outside. Yeah. It was frustrating for me as a child. So that's why I say that it was at once familiar and at the same time foreign, because as far as my home environment was concerned, I didn't experience and know I didn't know what he was describing in that arena, in that
because the Sephardic, the traditional Sephardic world hadn't undergone what he entitles the rupture, which involved a break from the mimetic tradition. You know, these, of course, were all terms that entered the vocabulary of Jewish discourse only after his essay, but what he describes as the mimetic tradition in which a community, members of a community are socialized into the religious life through the lived experience in the community. And in ways that broke apart in the Ashkenazic world, either he points to, of course, the Holocaust and the long effects of the Enlightenment, which you correctly point out were experienced very, very differently in the Sephardic world. So you were raised in a community where the mimetic was still much more intact and less ruptured.
Yes, I think that's probably the way that I would put it. I wouldn't say that it did not experience. The term I use in my article is experienced tremors, not necessarily ruptures. Although it's certainly, you know, the
as a native of Los Angeles, you know what you're talking
right.
about.
Right. Very good point. Yeah. Yes, I know them quite. I know those quite well. Also, no. So I think that's the point. It's that there was experience of disruption. Yeah. But not in the sense of, you know, not as profound, certainly not as sweeping as you know, as described by Professor Soloveitchik, resulting from, you know, the Haskalah and its long, you know, effect and the Holocaust. And so, yes, that, you know, and I'm very grateful to that essay, as I'm sure so many are, because it gave us language to be able to address, you know, what it was that we were experiencing and terms, which helped for us to clarify it. So, no, yeah, in my home and in my community growing up, mimetic tradition was still very much intact. And that was part of the problem, because I had nothing to point to except for this is what we do. Right. You know, but my parents don't do that, or my grandparents don't do that. And I would sit in school and learn about, you know, what we are supposed to do. You know, an example I give in the article, and this was the reason I give this example, because it was one that was very dissonant for me, you know, where, you know, you learn the halakha is that you put the Hanukkah nerot, yeah, either by the window or by the doorway or opposite the mezuzah. And everyone I knew, my grandparents, my maternal grandparents, my paternal grandparents, everybody that I saw was lighting the Hanukkah candles in the dining room on the table, you know, or on a dresser nearby. Nobody seemed to be sensitive to this, you know, what I was reading in text. Yeah, that this is what was supposed to be, and that this is what everybody.
Well, that
said
was certainly true in many Ashkenazic families as well.
Yeah. So. And I wouldn't have known that, because I didn't necessarily see what was going on. Everyone that I grew up with, definitely, you know, and even in Los Angeles in the 70s, early 80s, you know, you drove down the street on Hanukkah and you saw Hanukkah candles in the windows, mm-hmm. you know, which was nice in the area that we grew up in. And it's gotten only more so, you know, since then. But I felt very self-conscious about kind of admitting to the fact that my parents didn't do it right, mm-hmm. or that my grandparents didn't do it right. And I felt that wow, what was wrong? There was definitely a feeling as a younger person, what was wrong with us? Why didn't we care mm-hmm. about, you know, what everybody was pointing to in the text? And it took quite a long time for me to be able to find scaffolding around that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, the time that I spent studying in Chazon Avadiyah with the Chacham Avadiyah Yosef Zatzal helped me. Because I was able to hear an authority, which was, you know, nobody really disputed his authority as far as, you know, what we do, saying, no, there's source for this, there's reason for this, there's tradition for right. this, Mesorah.
Right. Right. Well, we'll come back to Rav Avadi Yosef momentarily, yeah. but that certainly was part of his larger project in making an argument for the integrity of the Sephardic tradition as lived experience.
I mean, there's a bit of dichotomy around that, which I'm sure we'll discuss, but, you know, because it did and it didn't in its own ways. But I will say also, I didn't necessarily have to get to Chazon Avadiyah to be able to see that, you know, traveling to New York, you know, Los Angeles is a little bit of a gola compared to New York, but, you know, traveling to New York and then seeing, you know, tens of thousands of Syrian Jewish families doing what my grandparents did on their own in Los Angeles was much more reaffirming and much more empowering. And it gave me a sense of feeling, you know, somehow we have to, and when I say we, I mean the Sfaradim, you know, we have to support this. We have to give, you know, divrei hachamim tzrichim chizuk, you know, it required some scaffolding and support and bolstering, because there was definitely, I mean, I love that language of Professor Soloveitchik, the self-consciousness. Mm-hmm. There was a profound self-consciousness.
So you write in the essay, I'll just read a kind of extended quote here. We, meaning the Sephardic community, were not immune, however, to the rupture and reconstruction that was taking place amongst our Ashkenazic brethren. We were not reconstructing ourselves with textual analysis and accuracy, the way that the Ashkenazim do or is described in the essay, but we now lived in close proximity to Ashkenazic communities in Israel, America, and Britain, and we began to feel self-conscious and awkward that we were not undergoing similar processes. In other words, we felt unbroken, we felt unruptured, right? And therefore,
yeah, we
need to reconstruct ourselves. And we felt bad that we weren't broken and put back together. But that, I'm interested in that self-consciousness. Now, that self-consciousness is an awareness. You are, as you said, you're a child of the 70s. You're an adolescent in the 1980s. This is long after the processes that Chaim Soloveitchik is describing in his essay. Is it that you were just half a generation behind, or was it something else? And what's the impact of that self-consciousness? To what degree is it still present in the life of a seriously textually engaged Sephardic Jew?
I would say that, you know, I can only speak essentially from the frustration. And when you are in a mimetic tradition, and, you know, mimetic transmission essentially is what is the modus operandi of holding a community together. You are not always, you are rarely hard pressed to prove why you do what you do. And more so, you are not hard pressed to prove it textually, right? You can say, well, this is what my grandparents have been doing for forever. And I still hear that, by the way, I still hear that dialogue in, you know, the Syrian community in New York, for example. You know, this is what we do. We've always done. This is what my grandparents did. And they can speak of an unbroken chain, you know, of saying, this is what we saw. And, you know, we have people that, thank God, are alive to have seen this. And the self-consciousness and frustration was essentially in the profound need to prove why we do what we do textually. And that wasn't always available. And so I can speak personally, you know, personally, part of my desire to be able to study in a Sephardic yeshiva, and when I say a traditional Sephardic yeshiva, not a yeshiva that essentially had taken its norms and systems from parallel Ashkenazic yeshivot, you know, that was part of my desire to study with Chacham Avadia, was that I kind of felt confident in his Misorah, right? And his transmission saying, you know, when he said, this is okay, this is what we do, or yes, I know that. I know that custom. I don't do it, but I know that custom. I've seen that. I've heard that. There was like this profound validation that I had no access to almost anywhere else. Mm-hmm. Certainly not in texts that I knew, but sometimes, yes. You know, sometimes there were obscure texts, which thank goodness he knew, that many of us didn't.
Right. There was hardly a text that he didn't know.
Right. So that was helpful. So that was the great frustration and self-consciousness, in that it wasn't just that we weren't broken. It was that there was almost this need to prove why we were not needing to be fixed, mm-hmm. right? Why what we were doing was not in and of itself broken. And that's quite frustrating. You know, it's a frustrating when growing up and trying to find one's own identity in an environment in which text-based authority is becoming more and more the center and prevalent in validating Orthodox Jewish life.
Right. Well, you know, this really brings us to the topic of Rav Ovadia Yosef. Now, I guess for full disclosure, we should mention you have a close connection to Rav Ovadia, not just as a Talmid, but through marriage.
Yeah. So I married Margalit Bar Shalom, who is the daughter of Rav Ezra and Adina Bar Shalom. My father-in-law, Rav Ezra Bar Shalom, may live and be well, was a dayan on the Beit Din HaGadol for about 10 years, and before that it was a dayan in Tel Aviv for many, many years, for almost 40 years. My mother-in-law, Adina, is the first-born child of Chacham Ovadia Yosef.
And a very well-known and well-regarded figure in the world of Jewish life and education here in Israel.
Indeed.
But the larger endeavor of of Rav Ovadia, Zichron Levracha, to create a pan-Sephardic tradition, to take these disparate communities, and I must confess, things really are so much better in this regard than they were 30 and 40 years ago. As a child growing up in central New Jersey, I was aware, of course, that I was Ashkenazi, and I davened in a shul that was Ashkenazi because everyone in my town was Ashkenazi, and I hardly knew any Sephardim. I was 25 years old, and I had completed the smicha program at Yeshiva University when I came on Aliyah. I am not certain that I had ever davened in a Sephardi synagogue in America before coming on Aliyah, or before you know, having spent time in Israel beforehand. I'd never attended a Sephardic service in the United States. I knew that in Brooklyn, there was a large Syrian community. I knew down the shore in New Jersey, between Memorial Day and Labor Day in those years, you could find a lot of Syrian Jews. But it was more or less off my radar. And probably like so many other unsophisticated people, I had a very distorted view of what the Sephardic world was like. And the irony here, and you point this out in the article, the fact that Art Scroll in the 1980s could produce a Sidur, which more or less conquers the entire Ashkenazic world. The idea that Ashkenazim, whether you're a Litvak or you're a Polish Yid or you're a Yekke, whatever your background is, we can all quite literally pray from the same prayer book, is largely unimaginable in the Sephardic world. I had no appreciation for the finer distinctions. And you spend some time in the essay making distinctions between what you call Eastern Sephardim and Western Sephardim. And of course, they experience things quite differently, particularly the effects of the Haskalah, of the Enlightenment. But the idea and the achievement of Rav Ovadia to take Moroccan Jews and Iraqi Jews, North African Jews, Jews of you know, from London and Amsterdam, from the Spanish Portuguese tradition, and so on and so forth, from Tunis, and to create a kind of unified Sephardic world and a unified Sephardic psak was a very significant achievement. It came at certain cost. Earlier in his career, he was criticized for this, because in order to create unity, sometimes you have to paper over division, and you know, division, the things that make each sub-community unique, are usually things that people find very precious. That achievement of creating what I'll call the pan-Sephardic world, which is actually described very well in Rabbi Benny Lau's book, Mimaran Ad Maran, about Rav Ovadia, a book which I should just mention I reviewed years ago in the pages of Tradition, and described some of these phenomena. So how does that play into this question of the unique rupture or reconstruction, or however it played out in the Sephardic world? Because in order to do that, it requires a little rupturing. It requires a little saying, this is the way that we do it.
Right. It's an excellent description, you know, how you've just presented it. And it certainly did come at a certain cost. I think part of the irony is, you know, that Chacham Ovadia Zatzal used text to do that.
Right.
I'm a firm believer, you know, that if it were not for the fact that he had such supreme command of such vast, you know, textual sources, which he used at his, you know, it was his handmaiden, you know, it was his tool to be able to present, you know, his thought and ideas. He actually told me one time, I'll give you a bit of an anecdote. You know, I was sitting, like you said, so, you know, I had the great merit to be able to spend many Shabbats with him and to see him at home in his, you know, in his own relaxed environment. So one Friday night, one Shabbat dinner, I asked him, because I had always heard the, you know, the story that he, you know, when they first came out with the Bar Ilan Responsa project, that they tested it against him. That they wanted to see whether he was able to be. And I asked him, you know, I said, Kvod Arav, I said, is it true that they did this? He goes, Ken, Yadati Yotir. He said, I knew more sources than. And then he said to me, he said, Rabbi Yosef, he said, Hayapam, because this was already, the Rav was already in his early 90s when I asked him. You know, he said, Hayapam, Hayushu Alimoti She'ela. People would ask me a question. Bekol Asfarim Ayu Niftahim Lefanai. He said, I could see the books opened in front of me. You know, that spoke to them. And so what he was able to do was to use his profound command, vast expertise in all texts, to be able to use that almost as an authoritative voice and say, this is the halakha, this is the way we do things. And it's not just me saying this. Here's 35, 40 other hachamim across the ages that are saying what I'm saying in one way or another, which is profoundly, you know, compelling and effective. So that was one aspect of it. And the other aspect was that he was quite a charismatic individual. You know, when he made a point of, when he was Rishon Zion, he made a point of visiting Sephardic communities all over the world. He was one of the first people who did that, you know, and one who had the first abilities to be able to do, but he took advantage of that. And so his office, his stature, his rhetoric, his writing, he marshaled all of that in order to be able to create this cohesiveness among Sfaradim in the world. But what did happen, and the cost that you mentioned, if we could call it that, some would argue, but if we could call it that, is that it did create this pan-Sephardic approach that kind of smoothed over or evened out the nuanced, unique minhagim, customs, differences, ethnic identities of the various Sfaradim. So there was this very nice rivalry. I say nice because it was friendly, but there was a rivalry running between him, for example, and Chacham Shalom Mashash, who was the Rav Rashi, the chief rabbi of Jerusalem for years and years, where Rav Mashash was a Moroccan. And he stood strong. He said, it looks wonderful that you have this P'sak Rav Ovadia, but the Moroccans don't do that. We say Baruch Hu Baruch Shemo when we're hearing a bracha that, you know, we have to fulfill an obligation with, even though Rav Ovadia emphatically said that's an interruption. You can't do it. He goes, yeah, we're going to keep doing it. You know, so there were those aspects, you know, in where, but Rav Ovadia definitely, you know, encompassed the entire Sephardic world. And he was uniquely, you know, he had a unique ability to be able to do that. So there was that aspect of it, which, yes, it meant that there was some loss in terms of the particular ethnic minhagim that people had come from their respective, you know, countries.
What Chaim Soloveitchik would have called the mimetic. Yeah.
Yes, right. So that did, you know, the powerful textual base of Chacham Ovadia's teaching definitely did tone down the mimetic practice, right? And evened out, homogenized the, you know, the Sephardic practice or approach. And Chacham Ovadia would have argued that it was for the better good. Right. That it was for the better good, that it was unity was better.
But perhaps not marked in the same way with the, you know, what was, you know, one of the central ideas in Rupture and Reconstruction is that with the transfer from the mimetic life to the text life comes stringencies, and that isn't necessarily what we saw in the Sephardic edition of this story that we're telling.
Well, Chacham Ovadia himself, you know, I heard it personally from him many, many times, and he was known for this. You know, he definitely did believe that the strength of a posek was in his kocha de hetera, and his ability to be able to give openings and leaning, of course, within halakha and within law, but to allow for people to live. And he's told me, you know, what he said to me once was, you know, it says v'chai b'hem, you're to live by it. And that means that we have to be able to enhance and provide the ability for people to live their lives in the most robust sense possible. So that it was overall, of course, there were, you know, there were points where he was quite stringent, and that conflicted with certain mimetic traditions that other Sephardim had. But I will say, I think that there is one important aspect of it that, you know, that to me I consider myself, although that, you know, I grew up in an Eastern tradition, I'm a Western Jew. You know, I grew up in Los Angeles. My family has been in
that is
the
quite
United
literally
States.
Sof HaMa'arav.
Yeah, I can't get much more than that. Pacific Ocean. And you know, my family on my mother's side have been in the United States since 1901. It's a very strong, you know, American, we've taken on, you know, American culture very much. And I did feel that, and I still feel that the Eastern Sfaradim, it was almost unfortunate in a way, and I say that, you know, with all the caveats necessary, but it was unfortunate in the way that they did not experience the Enlightenment as the Ashkenazim did and as some of the Western Sfaradim did, because what I did feel we do still need is our understanding, our answer, our involvement in the philosophical aspects of the Western world that have been brought out and essentially dealt with by Ashkenazim for 1,000 years. You know, if you really expand it and pan out, look at its earliest beginnings, and, you know, coming into modern day, that the Eastern Sfaradim don't have the same tradition. They don't have the same experience, and we are struggling a bit in the modern world in terms of being able to find our place and station within that. And I think that experience also, you know, it goes back to the question of self-consciousness, but it also is a question of, I hate to say it this way, but I if we're speaking frankly about it, you know, from an Ashkenazi standpoint, and even from perhaps a subconscious Eastern Sephardi standpoint, do we measure up? Are we able to have those conversations? Are we able to find ourselves in that arena? You know, So I think that's an important aspect of things.
So this degree of self-consciousness, which now we've come back to twice in our conversation, you make a point, and actually it's a rather bold indictment that you make of your own community. And I guess that's part of the job of a religious leader, is to kind of point a finger or to lift the mirror to his own community, so that we can understand some of the shortcomings by way of correcting them. But the kind of Ashkenazification of Sephardic communities, as Sephardic communities in the United States, in Israel, in Great Britain, to whatever degree they were strengthened, again, partially by Rav Avadia and others' leadership, in terms of Sephardic pride, in terms of a sense that we're not second class, that our religious traditions aren't inferior, but nevertheless, there was a kind of, you describe it as a movement towards a more Ashkenazi-esque way of religious life, which Chaim Soloveitchik had already indicated that this bandwagon you were jumping on was veering to the right, and along with that came the great astringencies and the chumrazatzia and etc. And more than the movement from mimetic to text was a movement from a more closed community to a community that was more greatly engaged with the Ashkenazic world. And here you point a finger and say the sheer outnumbering of Ashkenazim to Sfaradim meant that a great majority of all religious schools and institutions were built and led by Ashkenazic rabbis and lay leader. An education in line with Sephardic tradition was virtually unavailable outside of the mimetic reserve that was the Sephardic home and synagogue. And that abandonment of the religious leadership positions as educators, as rabbis, meant that there was an impact on the community. And how are we doing with that? What's changed in that regard? How do you see the long-term impact of that? Because the Sephardic world that you're describing of your youth is no longer extant. There have been many positive developments all over the world. So what's happening in this regard? And what are the impacts is there? Do you see a corrective at work to that that communal flaw, that rupture?
Yeah, I mean, I will say I don't want it to sound like I'm pointing the finger in criticism of my community and saying you know they should be doing otherwise. I'm looking at it as a circumstance simply of the historical, you know, imperatives of what occurred and where we are as a result of those situations. What I am saying is, we live, all of us, in a Western world now, and a world that is rapidly developing, probably more rapidly than any of us would like. You know, we kind of like things just so that we can kind of catch our breath, you know, right, in terms of keeping a pace. But I do think that with the opening and explosion of the information age, there's a great deal of challenge that comes with that, without question, but there's also a great deal of benefit that comes with that. And that is that younger Sephardic people want to know more about their own heritage. And in addition to that, I think this is a key factor, want to embed it into their modern lives. And they believe that it can happen. And I think that there are many opportunities for them to be able to do that. You know, I'll use an example. You know, the Rishon Zion, at the time, which was prior to prior to Chacham Obadiah, which is around the time of the Hakamat HaMdina, was Chacham Zion Meir Chai Uziel. And you know, you look at his writings, you look at his Higyone Uziel, and where he is writing about the need to recognize that all of humanity is essentially one, and that the nature of Jewish thought is not to exclude other cultures and other people and other thought and the world around us, and to be able to learn from that and understand how it is to incorporate into our lives as Am Yisrael and so on. I mean, that's just an example. There is source, there is heritage of thought that we can access and that we can draw and learn from. But I think that with the opening of our ability to share information and to be able to teach information and offer information, so many platforms in so many ways, that is a tremendous benefit. And people are looking towards it. I mean, I'll share with you that, you know, here in London, we're just beginning now. And this is one of the positive things that come out of COVID, and that we're taking advantage of the digital platforms. Mm-hmm. And we're starting a Sephardic, Bet Midrash that is essentially looking at these kinds of teachings, like looking at Chacham Zion Uziel, looking at, you know, the various, philosophies of many of the Spanish Sfaradim, or of, you know, my predecessors from 1701, Chacham David Nieto, who found himself essentially presiding over, for all intents and purposes, a Catholic community. They were conversos. They only knew, you know, and so he's needing to speak to them about what is the nature of Torah Sheba'al Peh? What are the philosophies behind our oral law? You know, these are aspects that are definitely starting to come into the discourse. People are seeking this. They're looking for this. They want to embrace these ideas. And we have an opportunity to be able to share that and teach that. And I think that that's, from the time that I was growing up, it's a tremendous development. We have access to thought and philosophy. And therefore, like I was saying at the beginning, scaffolding for our lives that we otherwise did not have, or we were missing before. So that's mm-hmm. a tremendous development.
In the face of a kind of uncertain future, and we should say, of mm-hmm. course, your essay was authored long before Corona struck. but in the face of uncertain future, you strike an optimistic note. But at the same time, you cautiously warn us against the break of the center. You describe the necessity that the center must hold going forward. So what is your...
Those were, I think, Rav Ephraim Goldberg.
You're playing off of Ephraim Goldberg's contribution to the earlier symposium.
The center must hold.
And he was not the first to say that, but his sentiments are very sincerely held.
Yeah.
But what do you see the future developments in your particular community and in the larger Sephardic world, the larger Jewish world?
Yeah, well, I will say the center is the toughest to hold, if we're honest, because it is, there is definitely an ease in being able to be drawn into the more extreme ends of things, because they're clearer, they are more certain. The center means that, you know, you're constantly having to assess, you know, how to interpret and understand any element, you know, that's happening in the world, the nature of the information. And I will say also that it's often the case, and this I think has run for all of human history, the elements that are more extreme are oftentimes more vocal. The center is doing a lot of thinking and doing a lot of assessing and is a bit slower in processing. And therefore, it requires pensive pause in order for us to be able to really, you know, hold what it is that we want to hold. However, I will say that part of my personal optimism is that I genuinely believe, because we can speak with each other across the world in ways that we have never been able to before, which also means that we can connect with each other across the world in ways that we have never been able to before, I have much greater hope for it than I ever have, because where it used to be that you had to look for kindred spirits in a particular community, you can now find kindred spirits all over the world and create virtual communities of thought and practice and dialogue and discourse. The very fact that we can have this discussion is proof to that. So that, to me, I'm general an optimist at heart, and I believe that, you know, the world is running towards a positive place, because I believe that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is running his world to a positive place. That's the core aspect of
even when we are sometimes like the proverbial rat caught in the maze or caught in the COVID maze.
You know, what I always say when speaking on this issue, I just say, you know, pan out. It's true that any place you insert yourself, it's not going to look pretty, but pan out, you know, look at the general direction. And, you know, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, his world is moving in positive places. And it's important for us to have that hope and optimism towards it. And I genuinely do. I don't only say that from, you know, an intellectual place. I say that from an experiential place. There's beautiful connections and interactions and learnings and experiences that I have had, and I know many other people have had, as a result of the new technologies that have come out that help us to be able to connect and form, you know, a cohesion and connection.
Or reconstruction.
Or reconstruction, indeed. So. You know, Chadesh Yomenu Kekedem, as we say. I'm hopeful and optimistic about that.
Well, on that note, we thank you for your time. We thank you for your essay, Rupture and Reconstruction, A Sephardic Response, which we were very happy to include, if posthumously, in our Rupture and Reconstruction Symposium from fall 2019. The entire symposium, the original symposium, can be found open access on our website, traditiononline.org. And Rabbi Dweck's article is part of our newest issue, summer 2020, in Tradition. Thank you, Rabbi Dweck.
Rabbi Sachs, I thank you for the opportunity to share in the time as well. Thank you so much.